Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In a day and age of extreme political partisanship, we revisit the beginnings of American partisan divide and a tragic and shocking event at its beginnings. My guest, John Sedgwick, has written an engaging account of the duel which claimed the life of founding father Alexander Hamilton. It's hard to believe today that this former Secretary of the Treasury, a man who formed the beginnings of our federal banking system, fought and lost a duel to the then sitting Vice President, Aaron Burr. In his book, War of Two, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and the Duel That Stunned the Nation, Sedgwick examines these two rival New York politicians, their rise to power, and their competition to shape the new nation. Hamilton was born in poverty, a self-made man, a confidant of George Washington and founder of the Federalist Party. Burr was his polar opposite, son of a wealthy and influential family, a Washington outsider, and a recent convert to Republicanism. Well, with the heightened sense of personal honor of the day, the two men's enmity and distaste for the other resulted in a personal affront. A challenge was issued, and despite the entreaties of their seconds, they met on July 11, 1804, with pistols. And of course, that ended in the death of Hamilton and the end of Burr's political career. The book offers interesting insights into the early development of party politics and also sheds light on our current sense of unyielding partisanship today. John Sedgwick is the author of several books, including the memoir In My Blood. He's been nominated for a National Magazine Award and has written for The Atlantic Monthly, GQ, Newsweek, and Esquire. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. John Sedgwick, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Rich.
How you got interested in this story of telling the story of Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and their duel is a really interesting one. You were actually researching your family history when you came across this really remarkable letter.
That's exactly right, yeah. It was a number of years before I started in on the book, but I was at the end of some research on this multi-generational memoir that I had written about the Sedgwick family that happens to go back to the time of the early Republic when my six generations back ancestor Theodore Sedgwick was the Speaker of the House in the famous year of 1800 when there was a hugely contested election. And he was one of the rare people in public life who was a friend both to Alexander Hamilton and to Aaron Burr. They were so antagonistic that friends usually had to choose between one or the other, but he managed both. And the last letter that Alexander Hamilton ever wrote before he went off in the morning to be shot at Weehawken in the famous duel, the last letter was written to Theodore Sedgwick. And it was in this archive that I was looking at for the family papers generally. And it was under glass, and I saw it, and I thought, it was like seeing an original copy of the Declaration of Independence. It was sort of that historic. I mean, imagine that this is late one night. Hamilton knows that first thing in the morning, before dawn, he's going to be rowed across the river. And yet he fills in sort of this bit of last-minute correspondence with Theodore that starts out a little chatty, and it says, you know, I've been meaning to write to you. I've been so busy. And then he gets into something that's about Burr without actually mentioning Burr by name. And it's complicated, and we can get into it if you want. But it was fascinating to see this thing. I mean, this little moment in history, it's not just the letter, it's the idea of him writing the letter that was so distinctive.
Right. At that point, the relationship between the two were, he had to suspect that this was not going to be a duel of honor where men fire their guns in the air and they're satisfied. This was going to be a blood duel
to the death.
Yeah, a blood duel.
Absolutely. But, you know, the thing that's fascinating, too, is that I don't think Hamilton slept very well that night. There is a story that's in Ron Chernow's book about how there was an orphan child that the Hamiltons had taken in. They had eight children of their own, but they added one. And this boy was having trouble sleeping, and so that Hamilton took him in his arms and laid back with him on a sofa and recited with him the Lord's Prayer and then finally eased him off to sleep, and then he went to bed. And I'm sure he had a troubled sleep if he had any. Burr, on the other hand, slumbered so deeply that it was hard for the servant to awaken him in the morning, which I find astonishing, you know, that you could be facing death in the morning and yet you could sleep calmly the night before. I just don't see how that's possible.
Well, and I assume once you saw this letter, you said, you know, I want to get into the history of who these two men were that led to this very fateful day,
yes.
July 11th, 1804,
yes.
In which the sitting vice president kills the man who created the banking system of the United States, the man who's on the $10 bill.
That's right. Yeah, it's an epic event. It was Henry Adams, you know, the great chronicler of the 19th century, called it the single most dramatic event of the early republic, and it has to be that. It's an astonishing thing. I mean, not only these were great antagonists for, you know, for decades, they're the highest representatives of the opposing parties. They were different in their backgrounds. That Hamilton was this penniless immigrant from the tiny island of Nevis. Burr, on the other hand, was the son of the president of Princeton and the grandson of the most illustrious clergyman of the era named Jonathan Edwards. Hamilton was as unset up as anybody could be, and Burr was as set up as anybody could be. There is a natural rivalry and antagonism and bitterness and envy and jealousy and all that kind of class consciousness that was laid in very early between them. And then the war stuff, the early, they were lawyers together, usually on opposite sides, and they were in the government together. They were like scorpions in a bottle, and the bottle was shrinking because, you know, as they rose in their power, they were contesting for a tighter and tighter space. I mean, there can only be one president. You know, and so that as you, I mean, it's like with the Republicans today, that as the space gets narrower, the anger rises, and that's what happened for the two of them.
Now, in Hamilton's case, he could never be president, right? He was born outside of the United States.
That's actually not true because, you know, yeah. In those days, nobody was an American at birth because there was no America. It was only later that there was an amendment to the Constitution that required that you be born in the United States. I think at that point, all that was needed was that you reside there. I'm not sure, but in any case, Hamilton was fully eligible, but he was not eligible by temperament. He was too combative, too much the Hotspur, too quick to anger, and he really just ticked a lot of people off. And so that, yeah, I mean, you know people like this.
Yes, well, you know, the thing about him, he was very self-righteous. He was very self-assured.
Yes.
He always knew the answer, and he would tell you, in copious detail,
yes, exactly.
Why you were
it
wrong and why
annoying.
He was right.
Yeah. It could be annoying. The thing that was trebly annoying was that he was almost always right. And that's pretty much unforgivable. At least Jefferson found him so. I mean, he in these cabinet meetings with Washington, Hamilton would command the room. He would speak for an hour on some rather intricate matter of interstate commerce, let's say. Jefferson would be kind of fulminating. He would be frothing. He would be trying to get a word in. And then finally there is a pause when Hamilton allows him to speak, and he's so flustered he can't get three words out. And that, I think that fed the antagonism between those two and the political differences that became all the wider.
And Hamilton was very well set in his political convictions. He was very much a Federalist. He wanted a very strong national government. He wanted a very strong government by the political elites. I think that was really definitely, and he had sort of made that change from being, you know, an illegitimate child in Nevis to a part of that political elite through his work already through his life.
Well, that's all true, that he was the original big government guy. He would be so out of favor now. But originally, he was just that. He wanted an all-powerful central government, and that he regarded the states primarily as agencies for enacting the will of the central government. And curiously, that reflected his own personal social ambitions to be elevated himself and powerful. And this is one of the things that I find so interesting about history, is that the more you dig into it, the more you see that people's personal background shapes their political beliefs and attitudes almost more than any other single factor. It's not logic that gets these people to the positions that they take. It's some inner need that's sometimes hard to discern. But you're exactly right. In Hamilton's case, he came from nothing and he wanted everything. I mean, who wouldn't? And he wanted to identify with the people who had everything. He believed absolutely in an establishment. He believed that only men of property should be able to vote. He didn't think that people should deign campaigning, that officials or political candidates should deign to actually speak to the people. They should they would communicate with the people through intermediaries, their quote unquote friends, who would relate their positions as if they were on tablets coming from the top of a mountain. And that was Hamilton. And it's odd, isn't it? Because Burr was born into that, but he was a man of the people far more than Hamilton ever was. Burr was the first one to campaign door to door. He believed in retail politics. He wanted to be able to connect with the voter directly. Hamilton didn't want to dirty his hands. And, you know, also, I mean, just literally on that point, that the Federalists, you know, they didn't touch. I mean, literally, they did not touch. They bowed in greeting. They did not shake hands. That was a vulgar custom that they left to the Republicans like Jefferson, who would be willing to do such a thing.
Well, and Burr, I think this was what part of their ire between the two of them. Hamilton felt that Burr really was more of a politician's politician. What will carry the day is my beliefs.
Right.
And there's some truth to that. I mean, Burr did keep his own counsel a lot of times. He never stuck his neck out on political matters that where he could get his head chopped off. He was, where are the sentiments lying? Okay, I'm going to align myself that way. This infuriated Hamilton.
Yes, he was a trimmer, in Hamilton's view, a vile opportunist. And at worst, he was a demagogue. And, you know, it's an issue that comes up in the campaigns today, is that, you know, someone like Trump, I mean, one of the charges is that he doesn't believe in anything except himself, that he will say whatever he needs to in order to make him popular, but he doesn't necessarily believe it. And that's a very uncomfortable suspicion on the part of many voters, not all apparently, but that, I mean, it's an issue that continues today, is that how do you get elected without saying what people want to hear? You know, I mean, how do you get elected and say what they don't want to hear, but is good for them? These are the issues that politicians always face. And that Burr, his solution was actually, he kept his own counsel, as you say, that he would very much customize his beliefs to the attitudes of the time, and that he would shift them as necessary, or he would withhold them as he needed to. He never took a position on the Constitution, for example, and he also, on the big banking bill, that he deferred to others, saying that, well, you know, I don't know the first thing about it. This is when he was a senator who was obliged to vote on it, and it's whatever you say, you know more than me, we'll do it this way. And then he was a sneak, you know, that he put through what became the Manhattan Bank, which is now Chase Bank, but it was Chase Manhattan Bank. This is the bank that Burr created, not as a bank, but as a water company, because New York's water was notoriously unsound, and that everybody, there was a clamor for fresh water that would be provided by this Manhattan Water Company. Well, at the last moment, as the bill was being considered in Albany, he snuck in a tiny little clause that said to the effect that it can be a bank too. I mean, like, literally, like five words, and hoped that no one would notice. But of course, no one did. It was the last minute of the last day that they could consider this, and everybody was beat and wanted to go home. And so in it went, and it was subject to review, but it passed. And that's the way he did things. He did things covertly. He wrote in code. He did, literally, I mean, he did not, Hamilton never, almost never wrote in code. He always did, if he wrote it down at all. He would keep it in his head otherwise, because he knew that information was power and it could be used against him.
Well, really, in your book, War of Two, you sort of detail these twin lives living at the same time, one from privilege, one from poverty. Both become very powerful men, both well-regarded in the Revolution, although one was this ultimate insider to Washington, and for whatever reason, Aaron Burr was not close to Washington.
Right. Washington was always on the lookout for smart young men, and that Burr came to his attention, and that he actually had a meeting with him at Richmond Hill, which is, you know, strangely, the mansion that Burr ultimately came to own. But it was, at that time, it was this was early in the war, when the war was primarily in New York, and Burr had an audience with Washington, and Washington said, okay, you'll do. 10 days later, he was gone, and it's not known what happened. But it's pretty easy to guess that there was something about Burr's sense of superiority, innate sense of superiority, that really rubbed Washington the wrong way. Washington was a much older man, obviously. He had earned his spurs. He wasn't handed them. Burr had been handed to him because of his illustrious birth, and that there was something about that that Washington really didn't like, and out Burr went. But months later, when Hamilton came to Washington's attention, man, they hit it off, and they not only won the war, but they created the government pretty much together. I mean, those were the two indispensable men in both campaigns.
Well, I would say Madison helped create the government, too.
Yes, but I don't think it was Hamilton who knitted it together commercially, and mm-hmm. that Madison certainly didn't create the Constitution on his own, although he was, you know, this notion of balance of powers, that was clearly his, and he was central to that. But Madison's presidency was not distinguished, and that he wasn't an especially powerful or influential man in the House of Representatives either, because the run of play was really on the Federalist side.
My guest today is John Sedgwick. He's the writer of nonfiction and fiction. His latest book is titled War of Two, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and the Duel That Stunned America. It's published by Berkeley. And your family also plays a role. He's your great-great-great-great-grandfather is Speaker of the House when Aaron Burr and Jefferson are at loggerheads, and multiple ballots to determine who's going to be the president in 1800.
Yeah.
A friend to both families. But let's talk about this enmity that grew over the years. Hamilton, very much the leader of the Federalists, and one of the sort of larger memes of this book is talking about our political acrimony that we see today that has been a part of our country since
the beginning.
Since this particular point is one of the when two set political parties come into view, the Federalists and the Republicans.
Right.
I guess we have to remember that this political combat, if you will, between our two parties have always been there when there's sort of a sense of equality between the two parties. None is dominant. When we have sort of more placid political times, it's when one party is dominating the other.
Right.
And this is perhaps the first sign of a shift of party. The Federalists have been in power for 12 years, and now the Republicans are going to dominate politics for the next 20 years.
Yes, that's exactly so. You're right. When one party is in power, and it's happened, you know, the Democratic Party was in power for the years after, through Roosevelt and after Truman. And that was a time when they really reshaped our nation, and now it's gotten reshaped since Reagan since. But the contrast was stark in the case of the years of the Federalists in charge versus the time of the Jeffersonians. It's interesting to me to look back and see that in some ways the Federalist Party inherited its outlook and style from the Tories, the disgraced Tories, who were the English-oriented settlers, mostly in New York. These were the ones who lived well, that they were elegant and knowledgeable and stylish and had money. And Hamilton, very early on, there was a case in New York where one of the properties had been taken over by somebody who it had been owned initially by the Tories. It had been taken by one of the Patriots, and the question was did the Tory owner originally have any reason to receive rent? And the answer was, surprisingly, in New York, yes. The Tories did have rights. That was an extremely unpopular position. Hamilton was the one to argue it. And it was pretty much a straight line from there about property rights, Tory orientation. And they did this in part because of international standing, that was sort of the rule of international law. And all of that fed into the Constitution with its ideas about property and standing. And the Federalists were the ones to embrace the Constitution with its strong central government. And that's what the word comes from. It comes from a federalized system of government. They were Federalists. And that's and then, of course, that Jefferson comes in opposition to that, that everything that Hamilton was as a Federalist, Jefferson wanted not to be as a Republican. If Hamilton wanted a strong central government, Jefferson did not. He wanted a weak central government with power distributed to the states and an agrarian orientation society, not an urban one. And he hated manufacturing. He loved farming. You know, it couldn't have been more opposite. And even in clothing, that he was a guy who did this vulgar thing of actually touching. He wasn't a guy who customarily touched, but he touched sort of for political purposes. And he wore pants for political purposes because they were more plebeian. Yeah. And anyway, so this is what came out. And so first the Federalists come in and they establish this government, and then Jefferson comes in and tries to dismantle it. And when he arrived, he was astonished and appalled to discover that there were 134 employees in the federal government. That was way too many. Well, but he tried to cut it back and he couldn't.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the events that led up to July 11th, 1804. It begins with, I guess, a dinner party where Hamilton makes a couple of remarks about Burr, as he was wont to do. I mean, this was not out of character for him, but the words get reported back to Burr.
Right.
And this becomes this series of steps that eventually ended this duel. But there's all these weird things that are happening during it. It doesn't come to Burr's attention till months later.
Yeah.
And in the interim, Burr has actually come to Hamilton's door in the morning and asked for a loan.
Right.
and Hamilton did what he could.
Did what he could. He turned him to his brother-in-law. Now, this was actually, but it wasn't the duel hadn't the machinations for that hadn't quite gotten started. But the antagonism was very much in place. And yes, exactly as you say, the critical word. There was one word that this all hinged on, and the word was dangerous. That in February in Albany in 1804, Hamilton was at a dinner party among friends, among Federalist friends, so he thought. And but his host was there with his son-in-law, who he didn't know. And the son-in-law then retailed some of the conversation about Burr in the newspapers, and it ended up in the New York Evening Post, which ironically was the paper founded by Hamilton himself. And in there, he says that he reports that Hamilton called Burr dangerous. Well, just as you say, a couple months later, it took a long time for it to come to Burr's attention. But when it did, he was apoplectic. First, because of the word, and second, because of what had happened in the interval, which was that he was the sitting vice president, but it was clear that Jefferson was going to throw him off the ticket. That he'd had it with Burr. He didn't trust him. Didn't want him around. And he was gone. So Burr had to figure out what he was going to do politically, and he ran for governor of New York. And he was leading initially, but then he was trounced in the end. He lost by a bigger margin than any governor candidate had ever lost in New York. He was outraged because Hamilton was the guy who had gone up and down the state saying, Burr sucks, and don't vote for him. So they didn't, and then so it was not only was he a dangerous man, but he was a dangerous man who had been done in by this perpetual opponent of his, and he was loaded for bear. So and what's interesting to me is that once a duel gets started, it proceeds by rules that are a little bit like matrimony, actually, where you get to know your spouse a little bit, and then you get down on bended knee, and then you call the church, and then you get the best man, and then you get the ring, and so forth. It's very ritualized that there was a series of letters that were exchanged in which they inched toward this decision to shoot at each other.
And their seconds are basically trying to find a way out of this.
Exactly. Yeah. They can see which way. At first, they just want to express their indignation, but then they realize that it's gone too far and that there's going to be bloodshed. And they really want to avoid that for the obvious reasons. These are very important men, and they're also their friends. But you know, once these things get going, they have a certain momentum, and it was really hard to stop them. And one of the things contributing to the momentum is this curious idea, long forgotten now, called honor. In those days, honor was everything to a gentleman of the class of Burr and Hamilton. It was your valor. It was your reputation. It was your manhood. It was all of these things. You could not sacrifice your honor without giving up something extremely precious. So they would do everything they could to hold on to it. And one of the things was that if somebody insults you, you demand that they retract it or face the consequences because it couldn't stand that your honor would be impugned. And sure enough, neither man could back down because there was too much at stake. There was their honor. They couldn't lose it. And that meant that they had to go to the dueling ground and fire each other over it.
And I mentioned the Burr coming to Hamilton for a loan. But before this came to Burr's attention.
Yes.
And that was completely forgotten. A week before the duel, they both attend the Society of Cincinnati, sort of the Revolutionary War sort of society that
Hamilton had founded.
Yeah, Hamilton had founded. Burr was a member. They're both in the same room and not necessarily talking to each other, but they're at least in the same room a week before the duel.
That's right. Well, because they were the same class and they did know each other, and that they were in the same circles. I mean, that's why my ancestor knew both of them. But it's amazing that in that it's recorded that Hamilton sang this melancholy song about it's our choice to live or die, basically, and that in the context of battle. It's not recorded what Burr said, if he said anything. He was apparently rather morose. But Hamilton was oddly ebullient. And you also have to remember one other thing about Hamilton, which is that 3 years before, he had lost his own son, his treasured firstborn, Philip, to a duel that was fought with those very same dueling pistols that he used that Weehawken to be killed with himself. And that Philip had fought, to defend his father's honor. When it was, he thought, besmirched by another soldier. And they had words, and things escalated, and then the son was dead.
Well, eventually it does end at Weehawken, although Burr won the duel. He killed Alexander Hamilton. The aftermath, it was obviously that Hamilton won the day because it highly disputed what exactly happened, who fired first,
right.
But Hamilton was mortally wounded, died within a day, and Burr becomes very quickly a pariah, and by a couple of years later, he's being charged with treason.
Yes, it's an amazing turnabout because Burr was the putative victor. He survived the duel. Hamilton was a putative loser. He was killed. And yet Hamilton's career went straight up after that. He was this was the marvelous apotheosis of Hamilton. He was never more highly regarded or treasured in his entire life as he was after he was killed. Burr's reputation went just the other way, that he was the most reviled man probably in the United States, and he had to slink out of Manhattan under a cloud. He was indicted for murder. He was a fugitive from justice, and then went on to wage the most serious secessionary campaign against the United States until the Civil War. He tried to detach half of the American land, the land of the Louisiana Purchase, from the rest of the country, and to establish his own empire with himself as the emperor and his grandson as the emperor, the heir apparent, and that with his daughter as his empress. It's it obviously didn't come to pass, but that's called treason.
The name of the book is War of Two, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and the duel that stunned the nation. And it's really a remarkable account of both of these men as they went through their lives, how they were intertwined throughout the beginning years of the country, and ending on July 11th, 1804, when they squared off in a fatal duel for Hamilton. I'm going to ask a sort of silly question at the end. You've spent so much time looking at these two men's life, and especially Alexander Hamilton. And, of course, what Hamilton is in the news these days is whether he's going to be replaced on the $10 bill. What are your thoughts about that?
I'm outraged. I have to say, I mean, take off Andrew Jackson, for goodness sakes. He wanted to dismantle the bank that Hamilton had created, and that Hamilton created the currency, and now he's getting bumped from his own house. I think that's... I think it's terrible.
We should mention you're researching a book on the Cherokees, and I think the Cherokees would completely agree with removing Andrew Jackson from the 20.
And his relationship with the Cherokee is abominable.
Yeah.
I can't get behind him. But he does have, his hair is magnificent on the 20, and that's something to consider.
All right. Well, it's a really interesting book, War of Two. John Sedgwick, thanks very much for your time.
Hey, Rich, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
John Sedgwick speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled War of Two, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and the Duel That Stunned the Nation. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.